Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. In the field of crime fiction, authors sometimes wear several hats. That's true of Joseph Goodrich, who's an Edgar Allan Poe Award-winning playwright whose plays have been produced in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and many other places. He also writes poetry, libretti, and what is most important to EQMM, short stories. The story we feature this month is set in Minnesota, the author's home state. Here is Joseph Goodrich reading his story, Shame the Devil, from our current issue, March-April 2023.
In May 2004, I was in St. Paul, visiting my Aunt Marion. She was in her early 80s and living by herself in a house on University Avenue. Proudly independent, Marion was the only survivor of the raggle-taggle family I was raised in. My parents died early on. My father when I was 3, my mother when I was 7, and I grew up with 3 aunts, 2 grandparents, 1 cousin, and a fox terrier named Pete. Marion was the oldest of 4 girls and had outlived them all. She kept her radio on day and night to remind her of what a house full of voices sounded like. It had been over a year since I'd last seen her, but she didn't complain. As a good Scandinavian Lutheran woman of a certain generation, she never complained. It accomplished nothing. Raised in the Midwest during the hardscrabble years of the Great Depression, Marion knew that thrift, hard work, and faith were the only things one could depend on. And, of course, love. But, also because she was a good Scandinavian Lutheran woman, she didn't make a show of her emotions. Her love was as profound as it was unstated. She was proud of what I accomplished in the greater world, was always glad to see me, and never made me feel guilty when I had to go. But I always felt guilty. May can be so lovely in Minnesota. I was there for the first truly warm day of spring, the first time you could walk around in a shirt and jacket without shivering. In a land of extreme weather, when a typical January morning might place the mercury at 15 below with a 25 below zero wind chill, such warmth was worth appreciating. Marion was out grocery shopping, a familiar neighborhood figure in her yellow polyester trousers and rummage sale baseball cap, pushing her rolling cart to Rainbow Foods and back again. I'd volunteered to accompany her, but she said no, she'd be fine. So I listened to KLBB and drank coffee and read one of the Nicholas Blake mysteries I'd picked up at Midway Books, a 5-minute walk from the house at the intersection of University and Snelling. I was 2 pages from the end of Thou Shell of Death when the telephone rang. The last thing I wanted to do was answer the phone, but I picked it up anyway. Hello? A blur of static and traffic sounds poured into my ears. Then a man spoke. Recognize my voice? I recognized it immediately, though I hadn't heard it in years. I hesitated because I didn't want to, or couldn't, acknowledge who was on the other end of the line. But I'm a writer, and it goes against my nature to let an opportunity like that slip by. Everything is fodder. Czesław Miłosz caught the point of view perfectly. When a writer is born into a family, the family is finished. So I let the conversation play out. Maybe I do, I said, but why don't you tell me who you are? I'll give you 3 letters, the voice said. L, L, L. Hello, Lester, I said. It's been a long time. L, L, L. Lester Laverne Lang. Uncle Les. I've written about Lester before. He appears semi-disguised in a story of mine published several years ago. A woman based on my Aunt Shirley discovers that her husband is having an affair with the woman across the street and kills him. This was drawn directly from life. Lester did have an affair with a woman across the street, the affable Eva, though it didn't end his life. It only ended his marriage to Shirley. Theirs wasn't a union likely to endure. Lester spent half of the year in our house in southwestern Minnesota, where he'd sectioned off a portion of the basement with plywood and constructed a bedroom and a rudimentary bath. The other half of the year, he stayed at his parents' farm in Barron, Wisconsin, and helped his father run the town dump. That's where he collected his reading material. His makeshift shelves were filled with stained paperback copies of Jay Anson's The Amityville Horror, Piers Paul Reed's Alive, Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch, and stacks of early 70s men's magazine, which all seemed to be about 2 things, the ongoing search for Hitler in the jungles of South America, and breasts. Lester's relationship with Hitler was, you might say, personal. In 1942, he lied about his age and enlisted in the U.S. Army to kill Germans and save democracy. He was only 16 years old. He wound up in the Philippines and not Berlin. I don't think he ever recovered from the things he saw and did in the Pacific. He rarely talked about the war, but when he did, it was horrific. With hindsight, I realized he was suffering from PTSD. Back then, we just lived in terror of him and counted the days until he'd climb into his Olds 88 for the trip back to the family dump. Yes, terror. Lester was a glowering presence in our house, a hulking, paunchy figure with an ungovernable anger that we did our best to avoid. Even in his infrequent jovial moods, the threat of violence always surrounded him. We tread softly. Despite our best efforts, his rage was, on occasion, let off its leash. He'd punched Shirley, slapped her, and once tried to push her down the basement stairs. Lester met Shirley in the VA hospital in Minneapolis when she was visiting my Aunt Ruth, a former Air Force nurse. Ruth had been maimed in a devastating car accident and, brain damaged and severely crippled, needed back-breaking 24-hour care. Shirley had been driving the car. Though I never asked directly about the accident, it was one of many subjects tacitly off-limits in my family. I suspect Shirley had had a drink or two before she found herself wrestling with the wheel of a car skidding out of control on a Minnesotan blacktop road. Corrosive guilt ate away at her for the rest of her life. Bone thin, given to nervous tics and twitches, Shirley sought solace in the harsh and distant God of the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church and lived on Winston's and Valium and fudge. Lester was also a patient at the VA hospital. He saw Shirley smoking in a waiting room and asked if she could give him a light. He enjoyed the occasional tipperillo in those days. They were married in 1963. 7 months later, my cousin Ellen was born, an angry, scowling baby who grew into a tense and withdrawn girl and then a suspicious, self-destructive young woman. I don't think the marriage would have happened if Lester had taken precautions. His affair with Eva ended it. Early one Saturday morning in October, Lester loaded up the Olds 88, drove away, and never came back. Until December 23rd, 1978, when, at 12:45 in the morning, Lester returned, unannounced, and four sheets to the wind. Lester drank. It shut down the demons in his mind, dulled the vision of a Japanese soldier's corpse churning with maggots, a buddy whose legs had been blown off after stepping on a landmine, a gut-shot Filipino peasant staring blindly into the sun. Booze helped him forget and helped him sleep. Though it exacerbated his health problems, he didn't stop drinking. That December night, I was in the attic, smoking Winston's, stolen from Shirley, and writing in my journal. At that time, the attic wasn't insulated, so I wore two sweatshirts, an old terry cloth bathrobe, and a watch cap. I just flipped the cassette of Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations when I heard a car pull up. I went to the window. There was Lester's Olds 88 parked at the curb. Its driver was staggering up the icy driveway toward the back door, a half-empty bottle of Four Roses bourbon in hand. "Not so good lately," Lester said, "but I got smart doctors. They think I'll beat it." "What are they treating you for?" I said. "Prostate cancer." "Oh." "Oh," Lester repeated, laughing. "Everyone says that." I look at it this way. Tojo didn't get me, so what if cancer does? A car horn blared somewhere near him. "Sorry about that. I'm waiting for my ride." "Where are you?" "Fort Snelling, for the chemo. They're real good to me. A van picks me up in Barron, then takes me back when I'm done." "Sounds like you got things covered." "Pretty much, yeah. And if not, hell, I'm almost 80. I've had a good run." He said nothing for a moment. The blare of traffic rose and fell around him. When he spoke again, his tone had altered. The cheerfulness had worn away, and this two-time recipient of the Bronze Star sounded exhausted and scared. "Something I want to say. I never had nothing against you, or Marion, or Ellen, none of it was your fault. As for Shirley, that was something else. All I wanted was a place where we could be alone, a place for me and her and Ellen and no one else. But she didn't want that. I never had nothing against you or the family, and he broke off to speak to someone, then said, "The van's here. Gotta go. Sorry." I set the receiver back in place. After all those years, Lester. I was more affected by the call than I'd expected. Lester. God damn. Wait till I tell Marion he'd called. Or would I mention it at all? Sitting in the kitchen, sipping a cup of coffee, and flicking ashes into a large glass ashtray, I thought about Shirley and Lester and that dark, freezing night so many years ago. The journal I was writing in is long gone, lost in one of my many moves, but I can place myself in the attic of that old green house in southwestern Minnesota with ease. The dark rafters, the orange candle burning on the small wing table, the street light filtering through the window, the sound of Bach from the tape player, and the intense cold. Standing at the attic window, I saw the door of the old 88 open and Lester unsteadily approach the house. I hurried downstairs to my bedroom and quietly opened the window onto the patio. I could hear Lester cursing under his breath as he fumbled with the back door. "Stop that. You'll wake everyone up." Shirley's voice. "What are you doing here?"
"Get out of the way."
"You're drunk."
"What's the matter to you? Just because you don't drink doesn't mean I can't."
"I hate it when you're like this."
"Freezing out here. Get out of the way."
"If I let you in, will you be quiet?"
"Sure. Promise."
Then the back door closed. I heard footsteps on the stairs leading to Lester's burrow in the basement. Then nothing. I stayed awake, alert for any signs of trouble. To my relief, the house remained silent. When it seemed like nothing bad was happening downstairs, no raised voices, no curses, nothing smashed, I returned to the attic for one last cigarette. I slipped my journal into its hiding place in an empty suitcase which I stashed behind a pile of cardboard boxes. Back in my darkened room, I listened to KAAY, the mighty 1090, coming up the Mississippi all the way from Little Rock, Arkansas. I drifted into sleep as Junior Wells and Buddy Guy played "Snatch It Back and Hold It," bringing hot southern blues to the frozen north. "Wake up." I muttered something, then rolled over to face the wall. "It's an emergency. Get up. You gotta help." I dragged myself into a sitting position and felt around for my glasses. First light seeped in around the curtains. Ellen stood beside the bed, pale and trembling, with dark circles under her eyes. I knew instinctively that something bad had happened. My stomach lurched. "What's wrong?"
"Mom's dead."
"What?" "I think Mom's dead."
"No."
"Yes." She tugged at my arm. "Outside. Come on." The street was empty. Sky and snow were equally gray. Lester and the old 88 had vanished. Had he even been here at all? Shirley lay tumbled in a snowbank. Her spectacles were missing and her eyes closed. Her nose was pulped. Blood ran from a corner of her mouth and from an ear. One hand was outstretched, palm up, as if she was offering something or asking. She looked very small. "He killed her," Ellen said. Her voice was fragile. "He hit her again, kicked her, killed her, then he drove off." She looked at me. "What are we going to do?"
"Call the police," I said, and started for the house.
Ellen just stood there frozen, hands clenched at her side, tears running down her cheeks and falling on her mother's body. The whole world was a gray and lifeless thing. In the house on University Avenue, I gingerly sifted through a series of painful memories. I remembered the arrival of the police as the sun rose and the neighbors gathered, Ellen's breakdown at the funeral and subsequent hospitalization, Lester's fierce, profanity-laden denial of guilt in the county courthouse. The jury disagreed and sentenced him to 15 years in prison for first-degree manslaughter.
He served 8 years and, upon his release in 1986, returned to Wisconsin. By that time, Ellen had been dead for 2 years. A lonely and troubled young woman plagued by chronic depression, she had run off to meet a pen pal and wound up poisoning herself in his dorm room in Austin, Texas. She was only 20. My coffee had gone cold. I dropped my cigarette into it and lit another. No, I decided. I wouldn't tell Marion about Lester's call. Instead, I walked to the video store to rent a movie I knew she'd enjoy. Marion loved The African Queen and Roman Holiday and Strangers on a Train. I hadn't seen Strangers in a long time. I'd pick it up if it wasn't rented. Any Hitchcock would do, actually. You can't go wrong with Hitchcock. Shortly after I returned from the video store, the phone rang again. It was Lester on his cell phone, on his way home to Barron. "Sorry about that," he said. "The van showed up and I had to go. I didn't get to finish my thought. I wanted to thank you for listening. You could have told me to go to hell, but you didn't, and I appreciate that. I couldn't be a father to you. Shirley didn't want that." Maybe she was right. I wasn't the best guy in the world. I drank, I ran around, I did things. But you don't know what life with her was like. She judged me. I couldn't do anything right. I was always bad, always wrong. He lapsed into silence. "You won't believe me, but I didn't kill her. I hit her. I hurt her. I said as much in court. I went to jail for it, but I didn't do it." "I do believe you." "Yeah, you don't have to. No one else does. But you're a good man to say it." The van driver said something unintelligible in the background. "Oh, almost there," Lester said. "I'll let you go. Thanks for listening. I'll call again sometime, maybe." "Fine with me," I said. "All right then, buddy. You take care. I love you." "Love you too." Truth to tell, I didn't love him. For the time he'd been a part of the family, I'd feared and despised Lester Laverne Lang. I hadn't thought of him in years, and when I did, it only brought back ugly memories I'd rather forget. But I wasn't going to tell him that. Why hurt an old man, riddled with cancer, who was only calling in an effort to make peace with the past? To wound this suffering old soldier would be monstrous. Hurting Lester would change nothing, bring no one back to life. Besides, Lester was innocent. The night before Shirley's funeral, Ellen told me. She had to, she said, because we'd been raised to tell the truth and shame the devil. After I'd gone in to call the police that morning, Ellen found that her mother was still alive, bruised and battered, but still fitfully, barely alive. Alive but broken, like her sister Ruth. Ruth had been a striking, dark-haired young woman who'd often been compared to Ava Gardner. High-spirited, adventurous, an Air Force nurse who'd traveled the world, she'd been destroyed in that car accident, transformed into a living corpse. Ruth was my family's version of the mad woman in the attic, the shameful secret we all had to keep. We went nowhere, saw no one. Only Pastor Leeske and 2 or 3 friends were allowed inside the house. Taking care of Ruth was killing Shirley. Ellen had seen what her father had done. Shirley would end up just like Ruth. And who'd be expected to look after her? "Me," Ellen said. "But that's not going to happen. It's not in my plan." And so, while I was inside on the phone, Ellen wrapped her fingers around Shirley's throat and squeezed until her mother stopped breathing. Lester had beaten her so badly, Ellen said, no one would ever guess what she had done. Ellen threatened to kill herself if I told anyone. "He's only getting what he deserves," she added. "Isn't it obvious?" "Perhaps, but I didn't like it. I knew Ellen would have killed herself. She'd tried it before with a bottle of aspirins in 8th grade. Shirley's injuries were severe and extensive and would have put her in a wheelchair. Going to prison would keep Lester from hurting anyone else and save his daughter's life. And so, with the gravest misgivings, I agreed to keep the whole thing secret. It was almost 4 when Marion returned from grocery shopping. I hauled her cart up the steps and into the house. "Gosh, it's a beautiful day out there," she said, placing canned goods on a shelf. "Will chicken be all right for dinner? It was on sale. Well, with some asparagus?" That'll be great, I said. Then we can watch a movie. They had Strangers on a Train at the video store.
I love that Bruno, Marion said, delighted. He's a nasty one, but so charming.
She set the frying pan on a burner. Any mail?
Just junk.
Any calls?
No, I said. Not a word from anyone.
Lester died 6 months after his call, in November 2004. Marion died in August 2017, at the age of 95. She left this world as quietly as she had inhabited it. It's easy to think of her in terms of what she didn't do. Never married, never flew in an airplane, never used a computer, never went to New York, Los Angeles, Paris, London, any of the places from which I joyfully sent her postcards. Her life seemed to have largely been one of sacrifice, with much given and very little offered in return. On second thought, I fear I'm doing her a serious injustice. If my years have been spent trying to transcend the expectations, religious, professional, personal, I was raised with, Marion's were spent in fulfilling hers. She did her duty, never refusing to grasp the nettle, never complaining. I spoke earlier of love, and I believe her life was filled with it. Love for her family, for mysteries, she adored Rex Stout and Ross McDonald. For the United States, she served as an election judge in innumerable state and local elections. And, of course, God, from whom all blessings flow. I loved her dearly and think of her often. She knew I had to leave, but always trusted I'd return. She was right. I return to these memories, those times, more and more frequently these days. The farther they recede, the closer I hold them. Here I am, Marion. Home again.
Shame the Devil is copyrighted by Joseph Goodrich. Music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Kevin Wheeler and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.